You're listening to Ink Studs, and my guest this week is Jake Puppy Teeth. Jake is a Vancouver-based artist, illustrator, painter, cartoonist,
multi-hyphenate,
general human creator of trash culture.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I like the low class.
Yeah, it's nothing's precious in your world.
No. Nothing is, nothing's above criticism.
And you, it's funny because, like, your work has, it's very informed by comics. You've, I presume, been comics reader for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But they've only more recently been, like, a very specific part of your practice.
Yeah, I have always kind of toed high and lowbrow stuff, and I've always read comics. I grew up reading, like, Dick Tracy and... I love the Fleischer Brothers cartoons, kind of that whole world, like 30s and 40s especially, has always been aesthetically what I'm attracted to, and I read that for a long time. But actually making comics wasn't something that interested me, especially until the last, I would say, 7 years maybe,
okay,
that I've been really into actually making storytelling through comics. I like making one-panel gag comics for a long time, and that's probably how I got most of my early popularity on the internet, was just because they're very memeable.
Yeah.
One-panel gags, but there was no plot or anything like that, and drawing comics is a lot of work because you need to actually tell the story. So I avoided it for a long time, but I'm embracing it now, and kind of, I think as I'm getting older, slowing down a little bit with my output and kind of honing it and making it more polished and spending a little bit more time. And I think that's conducive to comics writing for me.
Do you feel like you're shifting from, like, not just creating comics and, you say, slowing down, but also, like, being really purposeful of what you want to spend your time on versus making something that may necessarily be, you know, get a lot of clicks versus that may not be getting that same part of your,
yeah,
your soul?
It doesn't scratch the same itch, for sure. Like, when I'm spending time and slowing down on a comic, I'm not thinking about the immediacy of putting it out into the world right away, whereas typically I draw something and I want to share it with the world right away. So if I have a gallery show or if I'm making a comic and I can't necessarily spill my guts on the internet to, like, what I'm creating, it's harder, for sure, but I appreciate doing it, and I think that it's good for my creative spirit to kind of rein it in a little bit and spend a little bit more time.
Now, I want to circle real far back to kind of get to know more of kind of how you got to there. So were you, what kind of comics were you reading as a kid and teenager?
I never got really into superhero stuff.
Yeah.
I love Dick Tracy. He's one of my favorites. I read a lot of, like, Lil Abner, those kind of daily strips from the 30s and 40s I was always really attracted to. I like how zany they are.
Yeah.
And then when I was a little bit older, I started reading kind of, like, Will Eisner. I read some, like, The Spirit and things like that, and then some of his more... non-superhero stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got into Daniel Clowes and Charles Burns and all of those guys probably when I was like 19 or 20, and they've really influenced me just for also that zany nature, and I can almost see their influence of the pulpy daily comic strip, like weird Dick Tracy vibe.
Yeah.
Kind of imparting into what they were doing too, and I resonated with that.
Burns is very much about, like, the romance comics.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
just, like, how odd they were.
Mm-hmm. And just seeing visually, like, the black and white contrast that he creates,
yeah,
in, it's just so striking. And I'd never really seen it done like that before, so that was very inspirational. I like doing, like, high contrast stuff as well.
Yeah. Did you went to Emily Carr, right?
I did, back in the day. I think I graduated in 2012.
Okay.
And I went there when there was no illustration program. So
yeah,
there wasn't any kind of graphic novel courses or anything like that. I probably I've thought a lot about it. I don't know if it's for the best that I didn't have the opportunity to do that, but I focused on stone lithography and on painting. Yeah. So I've always been very interested in print and just physical paper ephemera.
Yeah.
My grandpa was an antiques dealer, so there'd just be stacks of old magazines and old things like old Life magazines and stuff from like the 20s through the 60s in my life. And I've always been, I don't know why, but very attracted to vintage paper. Even now, like, I collect old movie posters, things like that. I just love feeling old paper. And I think that my work, you can see it in there, the nostalgia inspiration, even old advertising and things like that, I reference a lot in my stuff.
You didn't grow up in Vancouver, though, did you?
No, I grew up in a small town in the Kootenays, a very rural town.
Yeah.
And I moved to Vancouver when I was 17 to go, like, straight from high school to art school.
Were you prepared for that big city change?
No. I was definitely out of my depth, and it was kind of like the only queer kid in the small town kind of vibe.
Yeah.
So that I had a lot of like growing up that I didn't get to do when I was a teenager, that came hard and fast when I was thrown into the city in art school, especially. But yeah, I think I bit off a little bit more than I could chew.
Yeah.
And then I had to take a year off of school and go back, and dealing with mental health and dealing with addiction and all of that kind of stuff that comes when you live too hard because you were a little bit sheltered, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Not prepared for what was to come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just having no strings attached to you, no family ties or anything, because I moved here just alone. So it was kind of just at sea in the big city.
Well, and I know Emily Carr, it's like one part conceptual school, other part party culture was a really big part of what was going on.
There was a lot of partying
at that time.
For
and
sure.
It was like art shows in Vancouver were really for young folks party based. Like that was like people were more there for the party.
Definitely. And not really even caring what's on the walls. And there was like a lot of art and music crossover, so people would go to the show and ask, or plan a music show and ask me if I wanted to put some work on the walls, kind of thing. Like, it was almost an afterthought a lot of the time, which is fine, but I feel like there was, the party culture was very real, and I don't think that that's a bad thing, but it was definitely, I wasn't in the set of people who were going hobnobbing at galleries and going to openings, going to the grown-up openings at actual institutions and big galleries, and I wasn't networking in that way, where I saw a lot of my peers were kind of getting getting their feet in the door that way, but I didn't really ever see that for me, and I still don't really feel like I belong to an art scene in Vancouver.
No, it's you're definitely, I would say, much more known outside of You've been, I guess, more in tune over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I've been trying to foster community, as they say. And I have a space in Chinatown, and I've been trying to host more things there and bring people out. And I'd like to be doing some more group shows and things like that there to bring people just to not see my own stuff. But I do like having that space so I can have the opportunity that I don't have to give a gallerist money. I can kind of cut out the middle person, and I don't really need to. I can be in charge and micromanage, as I like to do.
In your kind of times of difficulties in school and traversing that, like, how did that kind of, with your own, did you kind of come out of the end of that as like a different type of artist, or kind of really need to find yourself again? Like, I'm curious how you come out from, for lack of a term, like a kind of rock bottom situation and find what your voice is outside of
these
influences.
I had an ultimatum with myself, basically, because in my head, there's this romantic artist stereotype who can party and drink and do drugs and make artwork.
Yeah.
But I was just doing the party and drinking and doing drugs without actually making any artwork and calling myself an artist. So I had to acknowledge that and say, if you want to be an artist, you're going to have to get sober, because there's no, you can't have a happy medium.
Yeah.
And if you're on drugs and drinking, you're not making art. And I wanted to be making art. And that's like, is my driving force in life. So it wasn't necessarily finding my voice again. It was just listening to myself and knowing that that romantic ideal of the cool party artist wasn't me. And some people can do it, and power to them. I had to actively acknowledge that that wasn't me, and that lifestyle wasn't suiting being an artist, and that's what I wanted to be, so I had to stop.
It's quite fascinating that when you take out these influences, is just how that changes your productivity.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you can just zero in.
And I still find myself quite lazy, honestly. Like, I'm not, I see other artists and how prolific they are in making stuff, and I feel dwarfed by their output, and I just have to, again, acknowledge that if I was still doing drugs and drinking, that I wouldn't be making anything. So at least I'm making something. Exactly.
Another big influence I see in your work is John Waters.
Yes.
And trash, like you talk about trash culture.
Yes.
And, you know, there's nothing sacred in the world.
I do really like to take the piss out of things, and a lot of my earlier work was a lot about criticizing heteronormativity, which is what, like, a crux of John Waters' ethos, basically, is making fun of the nuclear family, making fun of straight relationships. All of that kind of stuff was fodder for him, and I feel like he was a big inspiration for me when I was a teenager, and just seeing that his voice kind of reached the mainstream despite him being kind of an outlier in society, and I really liked that.
There's something interesting about how you grew up too, is like being in almost like a Lynchian Blue Velvet.
Yeah, it was almost like a Twin Peaks town, honestly, like lumber mill, very like tourist town, so it was very lodge on the top of the hill kind of vibe with, it was very Lynchian for sure.
Yeah, and having to kind of push away from that, and
I wish there was, like, a seedy underbelly like Frank in my hometown, because I would have found him.
Now, when you were doing print type of work in college, in art school, what was it looking like? Like, what would we have seen?
I was very into, again, mocking advertising. So I would be taking, like, 1950s advertisements and repurposing them. So I really like working on with stone lithography, because you can work right on the stone, and then there's lots of blending, and you can scrape away, and you can kind of create an image. But it was initially my attraction to movie posters and how those are all printed with like early lithography.
Okay.
And just the looks that those can get really inspired me. So I was working kind of photographically, and then mixing some illustration elements into that.
Were you doing multiple color layers?
Yeah, I was doing, by my final year, I was working in a way where I was making very transparent ink layers and layering, like building them up almost like a silk screen, but with lithography, with photos of people that I had found from the flea market, because I've always been into ephemeral photography and collecting pictures of people I don't know, and kind of imparting my own meaning into them. I don't know how else to describe that, but making them have value that wasn't there because they were just at a flea market. So kind of bringing them a little bit of dignity back in a way.
Interesting.
By looking at them, by being inspired by them.
Well, and it's, it's finding, connecting with a stranger.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's,
and I'm so attracted to faces. My work, before branching into doing a lot of comics, it's just a lot of portraiture, because I'm just attracted into drawing a face, and its composition is a lot of the time an afterthought. So it's been renavigating how to build a composition with the full frame in mind, rather than just building a face and being that being the main focus of what I'm making.
And with those faces, it's quite expressionistic.
Yes.
Like, very...
Yeah, and a lot of the time I'll pull, like, a baby's head and then find an elderly actress and, like, juxtapose those two together to build this kind of fusion face, or this head that never existed, but it exists now kind of thing. Yeah.
Something from your dreams.
Yes.
Tell me about the balance, striking a balance between, like, being too camp. Or is there such a thing as being too camp?
Some of my comics that I've been making are very almost like Harvey in their saccharine on the surface. They're very, like, corny, I would say. But then I like to put a seedy underbelly into them, and they'll usually take, like, a very dark turn up very abruptly. There'll be, like, a hairpin where you're like, what the hell am I reading? And I think that... I think if I was doing just the saccharin, it would be more camp than if I kind of put the freaky element in there.
It's like adding a little bit of pepper, so because it's too salty.
Yeah, like kind of making it a little bit spicy, and I'm a huge horror noir fan, so I feel like there's always an inherent darkness in whatever I'm making, and there's kind of a little bit of brooding or malice in a lot of the characters that I create, or an inner fury, or there's no one who ever looks normally happy. There's always something that's they look too happy, or they look like they're hiding something, or there's always like an underlayer happening there.
Now you're talking a little bit about your collecting, and I'm interested in kind of being an obsessive person,
mm-hmm.
and getting these things, and do you find yourself falling down some deep collecting rabbit holes and just being informed and like having to learn more about something?
The more that you start collecting something, you start going further down the rabbit holes of the rarer and stranger things. I love collecting Dick Tracy novelties and things like that, and I think that when I started diving into beyond just the dolls and the pins and stuff, I really like the, like, crazier stuff that you're like, why did they make this? Another thing that I love is Munster's memorabilia.
Oh, okay.
I think 3 or 4 years ago, Heritage Auctions had this huge Munster's sale of ephemera or memorabilia, and there were so many things that I'd never even heard of, and I said, holy shit. They need to do a Dick Tracy one of these, because it's just stuff that I'd never, like, board games that there's only, like, two known to be in existence, and you're like, how did the, well, obviously it didn't sell because it was, like, a lemon of a product, but it's so cool now, but there are so many things that their rarity makes it so that people don't even really know, or at least me, maybe there are more attuned people who know about things like that, but I really love finding, like, the weird, strange objects. And coveting them.
It's funny, like, as we kind of get older with time and just knowing how much, like, you talk about ephemeral, and I've been spending a lot of time going through people's properties in this research thing and just seeing so much fascinating things that are just, like, as this generation ages out of existence, just kind of being destroyed.
Like time capsules.
Yeah.
I mean, they're... I think a large part of the problem is people who think that that stuff has more value than it has and are trying to sell it for money that no one wants to pay for it to keep it in existence. So what's going to happen to it? It's going to get thrown in a landfill when they die and their kids don't care about it. And then no one will have it.
I know my own family will likely have difficulties with my comic collection.
Yeah. I've been training my mom because she's a huge collector, but she's more like furniture, like stuff like barley twist furniture from the 1930s.
And barley,
like,
twist?
Those, is that like those, like, spindly legs, like they have like a twisted leg.
Oh my god.
Like things like that. Or like she'll collect big crocs or she collects things that are heavy and large. And I'm like, you need to hone this down before.
Have you thought about playing cards?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Collect something smaller.
Hummels.
Yeah, I don't know, not Hummels. Those did not hold their value. That market went bust. I think that there are so many... I've been really paring down my collection because I'm planning to move, so I really have been thinking a lot about how to keep the things that hold a lot of value to me personally, and that doesn't even necessarily mean monetary value.
Yeah.
But there are things that I have that I don't need anymore, but I need to find the right person for them. Yeah. And it's a strange world to navigate.
Yeah, collectors are
it's like we're niche people, yeah.
I think about like how a collection, especially for an artist like yourself, is also a reflection of your practice.
Mm-hmm.
And how that, you know, these objects are as much a part of your art.
Yeah.
As
there are, and for instance, I recently got rid of a stack of Life magazines that I've had since I was probably 16, I would say.
Okay.
And I'm 36 now, so 20 years. And I have been using them as reference material. I've been chopping them up. I've been scanning bits out of them, like making typefaces out of like advertisements and making my own fonts. Like I've been using them to death. You know that episode where Marge reuses the Chanel suit and
yes.
like reso?
Oh, of course.
That's like my Life magazine stack. And I was like, I need to let these go. Like I need to find something else because I feel like they've gotten me as far as they could possibly take me with using them, and I almost know all of the faces in them already. Like I know, oh, it's that cover, so this guy's in it. So I can play, like it's crazy. So I finally recycled them all, and I because they were too far gone to even give to somebody else
because
they were
just
like too
shit,
yeah they're so ratty and I'm like I'm not gonna try to sell these on Marketplace for $10. Like I'm not that person.
I don't want to meet the person that's gonna
yeah exactly. So I felt very proud that I've gotten rid of things like that, and I'm excited that I could start a new chapter and start finding new things that I can reference and get a new stack of magazines, maybe. Or not necessarily that I don't ever want to have something like that in my life again. I just don't need those ones anymore.
But part of that is like, you know, we're talking about how you've kind of shifted your practice into more comics based
mm-hmm.
stuff, and it's maybe part of that is also like what you bring into your home
mm-hmm.
and how you want that to influence what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm a maximalist. Like I like being surrounded by objects and feeling inspired by those objects.
Yeah,
but for I've always been inspired by, like, 40s and 50s, like, kitschy figurines, for instance. So those finally bled so far into my life that I decided to make my own. In the past year or two, I got into learning how to do mold making and do, like, slip casting of my own sculptures that
yeah.
I made. So making my own kitschy cookie jars and making my own weird figurines. So
yeah.
I do think that is a symptom of being surrounded by those things for so long, and I wanted to bring my own objects into the world in the same vein.
Yeah. No, I saw the cookie jar.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Thank you. It was a bitch to make, for sure, and I don't want to ever do anything that big again.
Yeah.
But I had made these small figurines. I made a ghost and I made a devil, and they were fit in your palm size, and I was
okay.
like, I could do something bigger. This isn't that hard. But when you start working with, like, that much plaster that wants to escape when it's wet, if you don't have it sealed enough when you're making the mold. I had some plaster disasters in my studio, and I did not have a tarp down, and there I'm still finding like things with like little specks of plaster on them in my place. So I don't need to be making anything that big, and the mold was just so large to when it got filled with slip to actually like pour out, like it was really heavy. Yeah,
I'm wondering because like you're moving into a space that's much bigger.
Uh-huh.
And is that something you're also thinking of, like, how to expand your practice and how to kind of take yourself out of the drawing table?
Yes, and I'm very excited about it. I'm moving into, like, a renovated machine shop that I'm building a suite in and having a large workspace. And it has three-phase power because it's an industrial building, so
oh, wow.
I can have woodworking equipment and metalworking equipment. So I'm very excited about the potential avenues that I'm going to start to go down that have always interested me, but being on the second floor of a non-ventilated building in Chinatown for 15 years has really hobbled me in the sense of what I can create and not make a giant mess and kill my lungs. So I've been I've been always very interested in making like wacky furniture or like weird signage or like making weird metal sculptures.
Are you going to turn into that person whose property is just filled with odd things?
I don't want to be... There are a lot of those people in that town, and I'm like, I don't need to be added to that list. I still want to... I feel like now that I'm kind of clearing out a lot of stuff from my life and moving into this place, I don't want... I want to start with a clean slate and not have a junkyard.
Yeah.
I'm from a junkyard family. Like, we're like a hoarder... collect old vehicles to restore
cinder
them
box.
Kind of family. Yeah, like, and I don't need to be that type of person. Thankfully, my partner is very not that type of person, and I feel I need to be respectful to him living together, that I can't go down that road.
Yeah.
It's going to be nice that I know that I can't go down that road.
The other thing about where your studio is now is, like you say, Chinatown, and it technically is Chinatown,
mm-hmm.
but it's also, you know, the per capita substance use
mm-hmm.
capital of Canada,
mm-hmm.
and it's a difficult area
mm-hmm.
to be in for a lot of folks. And
yeah. Like, it's heavy. It's a heavy place. Like, on your psyche, it can be
yeah.
a lot. One of the reasons why I'm moving is because... I'm finding myself lately that I feel quite jaded, and I'm at compassion burnout status, which is fair. I've been there for almost 20 years in Chinatown, and it's just such a place that of misery. There's a lot of community and a lot of happiness there that I see on a daily basis as well, but the squalor and the despair is very hard to see also on a daily basis, and it makes me feel quite jaded that I don't have the compassion in me anymore to I don't think that I can live there anymore and offer people any support.
Yeah.
So I need to extricate.
Yeah. I mean, compassion burnout's very much a thing.
I mean, I'm not in that field or any I'm not in a professional field. It's just being a neighbor to that for that long, and being as helpful as you can be and being as supportive as you can be, and then you get to a point that it's just, my well is kind of ran dry there, and it sucks, but I need to kind of face reality and go somewhere quieter and live a more peaceful life.
Does that factor into your work in terms of that dark sense of humor and finding...
I think that I've always been quite cynical. Living there hasn't... made it any better. I would say that. But I've always pondered this because I grew up in the woods and I was never inspired to draw a tree.
Yeah.
I was never inspired to draw a mountain.
Yeah.
I was never inspired to draw a bear. So
at least that
I've always been. Yeah. So I wasn't influenced by that. Around, like being surrounded by that, so I don't know how much I'm influenced by my surroundings now.
I don't necessarily mean influence as much as a response.
Oh,
like
I
when
see.
You're surrounded by all of this, and it's like it is, you know, you talk about that effect on the psyche, and like,
yeah,
as someone that's worked professionally in that context,
yeah,
you kind of need a dark sense of humor to make it.
That's
through
true. I do have gallows humor, and it is probably a response to being surrounded by that. I feel like in my work, I don't find it that inherently political. I mean, some of it is political in like, a queer way,
yeah,
but I don't find myself taking a stance on safe supply or on like any of those topics that are kind of raging down there and kind of causing a lot of problems. And I think that being down there hasn't turned me into an activist in any, it's not really in my bones. But I think that my work is kind of, it is a response to just general, like society at large, not necessarily that neighborhood.
Yeah.
I would say like what's going on culturally, I think is, you can read that into my work for sure.
Yeah.
I like to go back in time to kind of talk about the present.
Yeah. I'm interested in how you got connected with kind of wider drag culture as well, because like you did some work for Trixie.
Yeah, back in the day I got a big boost from like Trixie and Katya and a lot of drag performers. I think, I don't know how we connected. I think I was just popular on the internet from doing the comics and like the single panel comics.
Yeah.
And then they started following me and asked me if I would design merch for them. And then that kind of trickled down into doing posters and stuff for shows and things like that for them. Because I also, a part of my practice is doing graphic designy stuff. Like I love designing a logo and I like making show art and band shirts and things like that. I've always kind of had a practice where I'm dipping my toe into highbrow and lowbrow at the same time. I like to straddle that fence. And I mean, I always joke that every dog portrait that I draw for somebody is one more gallery that won't take me seriously, but I feel like I'm just at a point that I'm like, I'd rather draw your dog than have to work at a coffee shop to pay my bills, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make me less of an artist in my head, so I've kind of gotten past that. I didn't know
that you did dogs.
Oh yeah, I do lots of pet commissions. You can ask me, pay me to draw anything, I don't care. I don't care. I'll happily draw it. My commission-based work, I don't post a lot of it because who cares about some stranger's cat somewhere else or like a picture of like them and their partner for their anniversary. I'm like, I'm not sharing that. I don't care. Like, that was for you guys. Yeah.
You look too happy here. My audience is still honest.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that that is a good element of my work though, because I'm such a micromanager person. It is nice to have some direction and like be given like a set of things that have to be included in a drawing. It's a good challenge for my practice.
So when you're putting together one of your shows in your space, mm-hmm. so like the most recent one, you had a couple of drag performers.
Yes.
And I'm curious like how that worked in.
Well, I've always been attached to the drag community.
Yeah.
Like my art has been attached to the drag community since I was in art school. There was, back in the day, there was a Mr. Miss Cobalt back in like 2012, and I did the first poster for that.
Like the Cobalt Bar?
Yeah, because there used to be tons of drag shows there. So I did, like, I've been making drag posters for forever, and I've always been going to drag shows. I've gone to drag shows since I moved to the city when I was 17. And those are two worlds that I've always brought together in my head. And I eventually even started doing Drag Carnival, which was an event. I've had three or four of them where I would have, it was part art show, part performance art. And it was just a curated drag show of different performers. So I brought Trixie out to one.
That's right, at the Celebrities, right?
Yeah, there was Trixie at Celebrities, and I brought Amanda Lepore out for one of them as well.
Wow.
And just kind of showcasing, and I would perform at them as well, dressed up as my own character. I like cosplaying my own characters
as
well.
That's Pop the Clown.
Pop, Puppy Teeth. So I think that I've always been into a vaudevillian kind of variety show vibe, so the drag performers would always do very disparate things, not necessarily like a traditional drag show. Rose Butch once hammered a nail into their head at a drag carnival, like did the blockhead act, which was great. And Rose performed at my most recent show as well, and they dressed up like one of the characters and performed, I forget what it was, Stormy Weather, because I asked people to, I asked the performers to perform work that was inspired by or informed by the comic, not necessarily like dress up as Pepper Poodle or anything, but a large part of it takes place in a storm.
Yeah.
And there's a storm that happens and it influences the plot a lot. So they performed as in like a big trench coat. And it was very great performing Stormy Weather.
I wish I could have been there.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Pepper Poodle and Pop Puppy Teeth are your two kind of main.
Yeah.
Recurring. Pop, I can see that kind of Fleischer
Yeah.
influence gone very wrong.
Yeah. So pop is very Fleischer-y. I would say very Coco the Clown inspired, but with like a washed up 1950s like spin on it. Like in my head, Pop actually existed in the world as a clown, not as a person dressed as a clown, like just as a physical clown. And his career waned and he's trying to get work and he's perpetually broke and yeah. will just kind of do, he's quite unscrupulous and will do anything for money. And that kind of drives the plot for Pop's character.
And that was one of your first comics, wasn't that?
Yeah.
I got one of those from you a couple of years ago, but I think that came, that's like
2017, I think. Yeah, I did that one in. And I had a launch for it in Portland at the time. I was spending a lot of time in Portland. But that was 50 pages, I think. And I was just threw myself into it. And I work with a deadline way faster. And I'm a procrastinator. So we talked earlier about me slowing down and spending more time with things. When I look back at that book, I'm like, oh my God, I wish I didn't make this in like 2 weeks. Like, I drew it really quickly, and a lot of the things that I look back on weren't really considered, and I didn't work very much with storyboarding, with kind of, like, I had the script.
Like thumbnailing.
Yeah. Like, it was more just, like, wing it as I go.
Yeah.
And you can see it, it's quite amateurish, in parts, and I still think the plot is great. It ends abruptly, because I wanted to be finished it. Like, I probably would have gone another 20 pages if I could have, and kind of really fleshed out the ending.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. I'm really excited with this new book that I've learned all of those things, and I'm not in like a rush to release them, so I'm just gonna do it at my own pace.
Why, like, I guess because your comics aren't easy. Once they're out of print, they're out of print.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of your attachment to things being ephemeral?
I think so. That's part of it. And with this new book I'm putting out as Risograph Comics, so I'm going to do it in 4 parts. So I'll release 4 issues. Each issue is 25 pages, so it'll be a 100-page book at the end, in my head.
Yeah.
And I like that. For this one, I overprinted it, so I have a bunch of them. So when I put out the second one, at least people will be able to buy the first one with it. By the time I get to the third one, there probably won't be any of the first one. Like, it'll, like, so
you'll have to do, like, a cheap black and white mini comic.
Yeah, well, I'd like to maybe pitch the entirety to a publisher to print it as a graphic novel, which would be cool. I've never worked with publishers before. I'm very DIY. Like, I like to mail out my own orders. And it's, I feel like my reach isn't as big because of it. And there are benefits to publishing and self-publishing, but
it's hard to say because, like, I know for a lot of folks do quite well when you have, like, a certain, it's like this tipping point of how much you can sell of your own copies. And I just had, I was just chatting with Adam D'Souza about this yesterday because he as well has a lot of his stuff. He is just self-publishing his Mind Alley books and that kind of thing. But he also has a book from Random House, and so it's that balance of figuring out, and it's definitely like there is this kind of, when you have that level of control over your work and you're able to get it out and get it to people's hands, that royalty is going to you.
Yeah, you're making the money off of it, but it's the distribution is like a huge factor as well. Like, I'm not a knock on comic book doors person and ask them to carry a type of person. Like, I should be, but I'm not wired that way to kind of put my work into the world in that way. I should get better at that or hire somebody to do that. but the self-promotion is, and like writing an email to somebody to carry my stuff. Like, I probably should, but I don't really. I just sell through my website and at Comic-Cons, and I think that because my comics work isn't as frequent, like it's kind of sporadic, I think because of that, people don't really know me for putting out comics, so that audience is kind of like my regular audience of who buys my art isn't people who buy comics necessarily.
Yeah.
So I need to flesh out a following for the comics work, which is cool. I'm happy to do that. But I find that the crossover for my following doesn't necessarily translate to a comics following.
So people would be... There's the one part that want the Valentine's cards and the prints and that kind of thing, but it's completely different.
Yeah. I would say, well, not completely, but yeah, there's... I feel like at comics events and things, when I talk to people, they were like, oh, I know your art. I didn't know you made comics.
Yeah.
And then they don't buy one. It's like, they'll buy prints or they'll buy other things, but it's like, they're not really into the comic part. Yeah. But I'm kind of invested in building an audience again in a new field. Yeah. Well, not new, but in a different kind of way. Because I'm pretty committed to this new book. I think it'll be... It's a lot of fun to draw. I've been drawing it quite large, so it takes a while to do, but I like the amount of detail that I can get in there. And
it's so beautifully gross. It's just like the pages... I feel they're just like dripping in oil or something. Just like... Just something foul, and I really love it.
Pop sleaziness. I'm really trying to permeate that through the book. I feel like with that book, I really want to tell, like, a very twisted noir tale.
Yeah.
I can't say that's never been done before, because I don't read tons of comics, but what I'm doing, I don't think has ever been done before. I'm going to take it in some really strange routes, and I'm going to reference a lot of the things that inspire me. Like, in this book that came out, I reference, like, the traditional, like, insane asylum, like, locked away kind of electroshock therapy trope from movies from the 50s and 60s, that whole kind of lobotomy culture that was very popular. It's set in 1955, this book, so I feel like it's, I like looking back, as I said before, so I can kind of comment on where we're at in the world today.
And it's not a nostalgia.
No, I feel like it's a fantasy, it's an invented world, but it takes place in the past. So I feel like the people in it look, are their own people. Like, there's some people that look freaky, and there's some people that look normal, and there's a poodle and a clown hanging out, and no one bats an eye at it. Like, it's kind of everything it just is. And so I'm finding the world building is a really fun aspect for me, too.
And the poodle is your other, we're talking about.
Yes, Pepper.
Yes.
Pepper Poodle. She's very mischievous, very stupid, very malicious. Like, she'll...
Stupid
she
and
like
malicious.
Yeah, she likes to get vengeance. I don't know if I sent you one of the comics from Hot Rot, like the kind of compilation comics that I put out. Those are mimicked after, like, old Harvey comics, where there's different characters, like, in 4 or 5 page comics kind of doing their own thing. I find those very easy to write, as opposed to, like, an arc of a story. But there's one where Pepper gets cheated by a carny.
I read that one.
And she gets her vengeance on him. The traveling carnival man who looks like Liberace. But it's, again, talking about those twists that you don't see coming. It doesn't happen until, like, the last page where you're like, whoa, I didn't know that that was going to be in here.
I mean, Liberace to himself is such a great visual trope of just, like, extravagance and queerness.
I love Liberace.
Hidden in...
he is one of the visual icons for sure. He's very, very distinct person.
I don't know if you watched what you thought of that Michael Douglas.
Oh, Behind the Candelabra?
Yeah.
I liked it. It was fun. I liked how snatched Rob Lowe looked in it, like the crazy plastic surgeon. Rob Lowe looked really cool in it. I think Matt Damon was in that too. He was the guy it was based off of, who's still alive, I think. It's a funny bit of my lore. About 5 years ago, it was, I think maybe before COVID, I reached out to the Liberace Foundation.
Oh, wow.
To ask them if we could collaborate on some merch for the Liberace Museum. So I did send an email, and I like mocked up a lot of like Liberace. I had drawn like a lot of Liberace stuff. I had done like one of skeleton hands with all of his rings on them, and there was there was all of this Liberace pitches for. I pitched basically a merch collection,
a whole pitch deck,
and they were like,
"Please, we stay don't want away." That.
Exactly. They're like, "Why are you contacting us?" But then they're like, "Oh, we're really busy opening a Liberace steakhouse in LA." So I actually don't know if that ever happened. But yeah, they were like, "We're all of our eggs are in this Liberace steakhouse basket." But yeah, I did contact them about working together.
Oh my god.
They're like, who is this like random Canadian person?
Have you ever posted any of those visuals?
No, I haven't. I don't even know if I still have them. They were crazy. I was doing like the Liberace signature, like I made like logos. It was a lot of work, but it was just a weird passion project that I had as an idea in my head, and they were not receptive at all, which I don't blame them, but it was fun.
What could have been.
Exactly. And then I was like, my friend said, oh, you should just put them out as Liberace. Just put out a bunch of Liberace, make it yourself and put it out. And I was like, I don't know who's going to buy that if it's not like under the Liberace umbrella. I don't know if he has the fandom.
Yeah, I think you'd want to be careful selling that online.
Yeah.
That would be more like something that you find up limb type thing.
Yeah, it was a lot of it was caricatures, so it wasn't like using too many photos of him, but I had bought some of the like scandal magazines of him and like referenced those. There was like photos of him that I had like drawn on top of him to make him look crazier and stuff, but...
Ours.
It's no. It wasn't. I thought it was a love letter, but they didn't see it as a love letter.
There's this great Christian Archie comic that Al Hartley did. There's a whole bunch of Christian Archies. There's one that's like a beach party issue, and out of nowhere, Liberace's on the beach with his piano and a field of flowers in this Christian Archie comic.
That's crazy.
The wildest, most messed up thing. I love it.
That's great.
I love how like Liberace holds this like weird place in time that it's like you look back at and like
what were you people thinking to not?
How could you not
know? Yeah. So crazy. They didn't want to see it.
So the new issue out, very fresh.
The Cursed Ring.
The Cursed Ring. And then...
Part one.
How long do you think for part two?
Well...
Because you're drawing big. Your pages are like...
18 by 24.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And I'm planning the move now, so I'm like... And then I have Christmas season coming up, and I always do the Weirdos Market in Vancouver every year. I'm one of the organizers of the Weirdos Market. So there's that, again...
And you guys have a creepy Santa Claus that you designed for it.
Yeah, we have a Santa Claus that goes around, and then we also have, I designed like a big plywood cutout photo booth, like an old carnival, where you're inside Santa's mouth. Like, it's called Santa's Pie Hole, and it's like a big cutout Santa with his teeth are separate pieces of plywood, so there's some dimension to it, and you like stand in it as a booth and get your picture taken inside of Santa's mouth.
I love it. I know you did TCAF last year?
Yes, I did do TCAF. I'm gonna try to do it again next year. I forgot to apply for Short Run. I was gonna do that, but that didn't happen.
Oh.
But I'm also doing the move, so maybe it's for the best.
Have you been to Short Run?
No, I haven't before.
It's a good show.
Yeah, I think it would be fun just because it's a day, one day kind of in and out situation. I think I could sneak over the border with my books to do that. I don't know. Yeah, don't post that. AI is going to farm that. Find out. I think that TCAF I would like to do. I almost did the Montreal one this year, but I just like it as an excuse to go to other cities also.
Yeah.
But I've never done the Montreal one. I heard that the English comics are kind of segregated into their own little section.
It's a weird show because it's like three city blocks of these tents.
Uh-huh. It's outdoor.
Comics. Yeah, so it's outdoor. It's hot out.
Better than rainy.
Yeah, I mean, the previous year they had it in the park,
mm-hmm.
and it was rainy, mm-hmm. and that was really horrible.
Paper and outside.
Yeah, rains. It doesn't work well. This year, when I was there, it was the same weekend that VanCaf used to be in May,
mm-hmm.
and it was neat. It was very... There wasn't a lot of stuff for me at it.
Yeah.
It's very kind of clean type comic work.
Like what kind of clean? Like clean style or clean substance?
Or both? Substance.
Yeah.
Like the...
Like twee?
Yeah. Just stuff that's like good for families.
Uh-huh.
There was a couple of neat things where... that were unofficial events that these other folks put on that were, like, in bars on the same street.
Okay.
That there was some neat stuff in.
Yeah.
Like, Julie Doucet was in one of the bars okay. one day, you know, and very happy. And that's the kind of... That gives you the difference of the type of show.
Yeah.
It's like, the road is doesn't have Julie Doucet except when she's signing for her publishers.
Yeah.
But then also they had... oh, God, I can't remember her name that did Melody, the... comic about the autobio comic about being a stripper in Montreal in the early 80s.
Oh, I've seen that.
Sylvie Rancourt.
Okay.
She was there tabling, so that was really fascinating. It's
yeah.
part of the whole festival, and I bought a stack of stuff off of her.
That's cool.
Couldn't speak a word with her because I'm absolutely no French and she does not speak English.
That's all right.
So that's the other piece is like these types of things it is.
Yeah.
A different type of...
I think that... Yeah, I just like going to other cities to try to experience the city and just learn see people who I haven't met before.
Yeah.
Last year at TCAF, I was seated across from Johnny Ryan, so they kind of put like the smut peddlers next to each other, which was kind of fun.
Very different work.
Yeah, very different, but some crossover, but yeah.
You're not really an edgelord.
Like, I'm definitely not an edgelord. But I appreciate some of the stuff he does. Like, I think
yeah.
he's funny. It was fun to be next or across from each other so we could see each other. There was crossover in customers for sure, which is, does that make our work related? I don't know. I don't know. Same people were coming to both tables. My phone fell. But I think that I will apply for TCAF again. And the next book would be out by then, for sure. That would be my deadline.
So more people will see you in other places.
Hopefully. Yes, yeah. I'll try to. I want to get out and start doing stuff more. I won't be, like, super far away from Calgary when I move. And I don't know. I know there's some stuff in the prairies that happens. There's a Saskatoon or...
The Winnipeg has a Prairie Comics Fest in beginning of September.
Okay.
But the problem is once October hits, it just turns into winter.
Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah.
You'll probably experience that too.
I can deal with winter. I'm okay.
Yeah. Jake, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Coming to my house and meeting my cat.
Very sweet.
Yeah. Jake's new book, The Cursed Ring, available through whatever
through
channels you have.
Puppyteeth.com.
There we go. Awesome.
Thank you
so much, Jake.